Today is Wednesday, January 16th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, the Islamic State terror group is claiming responsibility for a bombing in northern Syria that killed four U.S. soldiers. We'll look at what this means for the future of Syria. The British Prime Minister faces a no-confidence vote in Parliament. We'll go live to London. And we'll tell you about a new TV ad that has social media buzzing. It's all on today's International Edition. British Prime Minister Theresa May is facing a no-confidence vote after members of Parliament voted overwhelmingly against her plan to divorce Britain from the European Union. Henry Ridgewell has been following developments for VOA and joins us from London. Henry, let's begin by better understanding what happened yesterday in Parliament.
Yesterday, Jim, there was the biggest defeat in modern political history for Theresa May's deal that she struck with the European Union. The vote had already been delayed by 1 month because back in December, Theresa May knew that she faced defeat. So she took a few weeks to try to convince more lawmakers that this was the way forward on Brexit. But she failed pretty spectacularly. She lost the vote by 230 votes of lawmakers. So a resounding defeat for that deal that she had struck with Brussels, which would have seen Britain leave the European Union on March the 29th and have a two-year transition period and then work on building a trade arrangement after that. Politically, what that means is that she faces a very difficult position in that there's no obvious way forward for the Brexit process. And as you mentioned today, she's facing this vote of no confidence.
Well, let's put the vote aside for a second. And you make a very good point. How does this go forward?
It's very difficult to predict exactly what path Brexit will take now. There are around five or six different options that could take place for Britain to either leave or stay in the European Union. All of them look unlikely, very difficult to achieve, but one of them has got to happen. If we start with what happened yesterday with Theresa May's deal, this is a deal that has taken 2 years to negotiate, one that both she and other European Union leaders say is the only deal on offer, one that will ensure a smooth exit and a good relationship between Britain and the European Union in the future. But the scale of the defeat that she faced yesterday makes it very difficult to see how she can resuscitate that deal and make it palatable to lawmakers to convince more than 100 of them to change their minds and to get it through Parliament. So that possibility looks unlikely. Then there's already the legislation in place to say that Britain will leave the European Union on the 29th of March. So the default option, if nothing else happens, is that Britain will leave anyway, with or without a deal, on the 29th of March. But all the warnings are that Britain crashing out without a deal would be so catastrophic for the UK economy and very bad indeed for the European economy that most politicians on both sides are desperately trying to avoid that scenario as well. And then there's the option of a general election, which is what the opposition Labour Party is pushing for with this vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister and her government today. But that looks equally unlikely because despite that huge defeat yesterday, Theresa May's own lawmakers and those from the Democratic Unionist Party that support her party in government, though they don't like her deal, they don't want to see the government fall. So they will most likely support her today. So a general election looks unlikely. Then there's the option of yet another referendum on Britain's future in the European Union. Some lawmakers back that, but not enough to get it through Parliament either. And there are big questions over whether that would be acceptable politically, constitutionally, within the United Kingdom. So we have these range of options, all of them very difficult to see happening, but one of them has to happen in the coming months.
Henry, we have about 30 seconds left. Is all this turmoil having an impact on Britain's economy?
There are now visible signs, yes, that this is having an impact. There were dire warnings initially of the impact of Brexit, which perhaps haven't played out. But most recently, we've had a series of announcements of job cuts from huge firms like car makers, Jaguar Land Rover, Ford. We've had warnings from Japanese car makers that they may cut production here. So I think finally those warnings that Brexit will hit the economy, and especially a no-deal Brexit, are coming to fruition to some extent, but perhaps not an absolute disaster yet. Most companies appear to be waiting for the very end to see what will happen.
Henry Ridgewell in London, thank you for joining us on International Edition. The White House has doubled projections of how much economic damage the U.S. partial government shutdown is causing. A high-level U.S. diplomat responsible for negotiations with the Taliban says the insurgent group must engage with the Afghan government if they want the peace process to move forward. Australian federal police have arrested two international airline employees for allegedly smuggling high-grade heroin into Sydney and Melbourne as part of a major trafficking ring. ICC prosecutors will appeal the acquittal of ex-Ivory Coast President Gbagbo on war crimes charges. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers from the University of California, Irvine, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and the Netherlands Utrecht University suggests the Antarctic ice sheet is losing about six times the ice each year than it did 40 years ago. The researchers found that between 1979 and 1990, Antarctica lost an average of 40 billion metric tons of ice each year. In each year between 2009 to 2017, the average annual ice loss increased to about 252 billion tons. In addition, the U.S. and Dutch researchers found evidence that sea levels around the world rose by more than 1.27 centimeters during the same 40-year period. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you for joining us for VOA's International Edition. A terrorist attack in northern Syria has killed at least four U.S. soldiers. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility. Joining us to help us better understand the attack and its impact on the U.S. troop withdrawal is VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, let's start out by explaining what happened today.
So from what we know so far, there was an international coalition patrol that was moving through the city of Manbij. And according to some sources on the ground, the U.S. portion of that patrol was going to meet with some of their Syrian Democratic Force counterparts in the city, which are, again, mostly made up of Kurdish forces, at which point a suicide bomber apparently ran up to this convoy, detonated a vest, and you had multiple fatalities. We're hearing now from the U.S. That some Americans have been killed. A U.S. official has said that as many as four U.S. troops were killed, with another three injured. There are also a number of civilian fatalities as the attack took place in the middle, near the center market area of Manbij, near a restaurant where apparently the Americans have often met with some of their SDF counterparts.
The video of the carnage is just awful when you get a chance to see that. Now, does today's attack contradict the message from Washington that the Islamic State has been defeated?
Well, it's interesting because there are multiple messages from Washington. So which one? Just a little while ago, Vice President Mike Pence was giving a speech, and he talked about how the fight against Islamic State was over. In a sense, he said that, quote, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners. He said the caliphate has crumbled and ISIS has been defeated. And he goes on to say that while the U.S. will stay in the region to make sure that ISIS doesn't rear its head again, he said the U.S. troops are coming home. Now, we've also heard from the Pentagon that while they are starting to implement the withdrawal that's been called for by President Donald Trump, so far, all they've done is pull out equipment that, until conditions on the ground are met, they are going to be leaving U.S. troops in Syria where they are. And there are about 2,000 of them, some of them based just outside of Manbij. But on top of that, we know from the Pentagon's own estimates, from intelligence officials in the U.S. and in other Western countries, other allied countries, that despite the fact that the caliphate is in tatters and there's just a small pocket of resistance left, that ISIS still has anywhere from 10 to 12, 13,000 estimated fighters in Syria alone. There's been concern that they've been in sleeper cells. There's concern that they are hiding in areas that the U.S. and its partner forces do not operate, areas that are controlled by the regime, the Syrian regime, or by the Russians. So there are lots of questions about how effective a fighting force Islamic State still has. There have been some reports from the U.N. saying that despite the collapse of the caliphate, that the chain of command within Islamic State and their ability to operate, their ability to access money and other resources still existed in Syria, and that they were showing some ability to remain coherent and operate effectively as an insurgent group as opposed to a caliphate or a proto-state.
Well, apparently the announcement of the withdrawal has emboldened the Islamic State. What does today's attack and the withdrawal of U.S. forces mean for the security situation in Syria?
This is a complicated situation, and it's probably notable that if this is the Islamic State has claimed the attack. We don't have any confirmation from the U.S. that they are indeed responsible, but assuming for a second that perhaps Islamic State is being truthful in this claim, and they're not always such, but if they are, it's significant that it happens in Manbij, which has been a flashpoint between the Kurdish forces that have been fighting with the U.S. and Turkey, which sees those forces as connected to a terrorist group within Turkey, and Turkey itself has said it's willing to go into northern Syria, into Manbij, to wipe out the terrorists, not just Islamic State, but also the YPG, this Kurdish militia that's been fighting with the U.S. In addition, you have Russia at play. Russia has been trying to help negotiate a deal in northern Syria, and in the last couple of weeks, they've said repeatedly how some of their military units in Syria have been conducting patrols in and around this area in Manbij. So you have Islamic State potentially carrying off an attack where you have Russian forces, regime forces, U.S.-backed forces, and U.S. forces themselves.
Quickly, before we let you go, share your Twitter account with us because you're always providing great information.
I can be followed at Twitter at JSELDIN at JSeldon.
Okay. For all the latest, be sure to follow Jeff. And Jeff, thank you for joining us here on International Edition.
Anytime.
Kenya's president has issued a strong warning to the terrorists who attacked a luxury hotel and office complex in Nairobi Tuesday. John Tanza reports for VOA from Nairobi.
President Uhuru Kenyatta addressed the nation hours after the attack at the Suite D2 Hotel in Westlands, an upscale suburb of the capital, Nairobi.
Multiple security efforts are underway to detect, deter, disrupt, and defeat any terrorist operatives or groups. We are also on highest alert and shall remain so. I assure every Kenyan and our foreign visitors that you are safe in Kenya.
Wednesday morning, Secretary of Interior Fred Matiang'i told reporters at the scene of the attack that phase one of the police operation is over. He declined to comment on the number of attackers killed.
This is a security operation and it's going on. When a security operation is going on, as a rule of thumb, you cannot start running sideline comments when it is going on. We have been able to take out all the attackers who came here, and that is it for now.
The Islamist militant Al-Shabaab, based in Somalia, has claimed responsibility for the attack. Authorities have not confirmed that. However, Al-Shabaab has been linked to previous attacks in Kenya, apparently in retaliation for Kenya's support of the Mogadishu government. An official with the Kenyan Red Cross told reporters that 18 people were injured and around 700 were evacuated from the Desuit complex on Tuesday. The attack began with an explosion, and then there were 3 hours of gunfire as police worked to clear the complex. The president says the objectives of the police operation was to rescue those trapped in offices, hotel rooms, and other facilities.
The operational priority of the security services was first and foremost to safeguard civilian life. They acted swiftly to contain the attackers and methodically evacuate those whose lives were at risk.
The Kenyan president warned his government is launching an aggressive manhunt for all those involved in the attack.
I convened and chaired a meeting of our National Security Council And I want to say this. We will seek out every person that was involved in the funding, planning, and execution of this heinous act. We will pursue relentlessly wherever they will be until they are held to account.
Most of those killed were Kenyan citizens. The U.S. State Department has confirmed one American citizen was among the 14 people killed, and Britain's Foreign Office said a British man also died. John Tanza for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, John, and this is International Edition. A New York Times report says President Donald Trump told aides on several occasions last year that he wanted to withdraw the United States from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO has been in place since 1949. While President Trump has gone back and forth on the issue in public, foreign policy experts say the move would weaken the alliance and embolden Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has long criticized NATO. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
For some 70 years, NATO has been viewed as a crucial pillar of stability by U.S. presidents and lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans alike. But Trump's views on the alliance during his 2016 campaign broke with that bipartisan consensus.
Let me tell you, NATO is obsolete. It was 67 years, or it's over 60 years old. It is many countries, doesn't cover terrorism, okay? It covers the Soviet Union, which is no longer in existence.
Since his election, President Trump has said he no longer considers NATO obsolete. But he has repeatedly pressed European allies to increase their contributions, like at this summit last July.
For years, presidents have been coming to these meetings and talked about the expense, the tremendous expense for the United States, and tremendous progress has been made. Everyone's agreed to substantially up their commitment. They're going to up it at levels that they've never thought of before.
Reacting to Tuesday's New York Times report, analysts say the recent departure of Defense Secretary James Mattis has them worried about the future of NATO.
I think Secretary Mattis was the primary brake on President Trump's ambitions and interests in leaving the alliance. His removal creates an unbelievable opportunity for the president and for anyone else in the administration who does not see the value of the NATO alliance to push forward with withdrawal.
If this happens, Russian President Vladimir Putin would be the main benefactor, warns Simakovsky.
It would be a significant gift to him, and he would see it as an open invitation for future aggression in Europe.
Some experts say it may be time for the U.S. Congress to send a message to the president by holding a symbolic vote expressing how vital NATO is to U.S. national security and world stability. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Still ahead, how your heart can create art. But first, a new TV ad is creating buzz on social media. Razor brand Gillette has created a Me Too movement-themed advertising campaign. It addresses traditional cultural examples of masculinity, but the video had stirred controversy among some of their consumers. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy reports.
Bullying. The Me Too movement against sexual harassment.
Toxic masculinity.
It's an ad that set the internet ablaze. Gillette's new razor commercial takes aim at toxic masculinity in light of the Me Too movement. And it's earned both acclaim and backlash.
It's taking over.
Since Sunday, it's racked up millions of views on YouTube, tens of thousands of comments on its tweet, and over 100,000 shares of its Facebook post. The ad turns Gillette's old tagline on its head, asking, is this the best a man can get? It focuses on leaving behind the old adage,
boys will be boys,
when it justifies bad behavior. As examples, it portrays men and boys who bully, lust after women, and put female colleagues down in the workplace. A representative from Gillette told Reuters the video was meant to start a conversation, and there's no arguing that it's done just that. There's been calls to throw out Gillette products and boycott the brand. Some taking that very literally.
Everything under the sun is getting trashed.
To its opponents, they say the ad negatively portrays all men. British TV personality Piers Morgan went on an hours-long tweet storm, taking aim at the ad and its supporters, saying the ad presumes all men are bad until they're directed otherwise. If they did this to women, feminists would go crazy.
I am strong.
The company says the fact it's got people talking about the issue is a win in itself.
That's Reuters' Michelle Hennessy reporting. Now, take a minute and think about your heart. Can you hear it beating? Probably not, but you know it is. Now imagine your heartbeat in color with rhythmic lighting to match. You can now see your unique beat pattern at a new interactive exhibit called Pulse at the Hirshhorn Museum here in Washington. VOA's Carolyn Persutti tells us how your heartbeat joins others and becomes art.
You see it before you hear it. That's a heart. The lights dance to its pulsing beat. Grab the sensors and the closest light bulb flickers. Your heartbeat joins the hundreds of others before you as the bulbs strobe to match your heart's rhythm. This is Pulse, an interactive exhibit at Washington's Hirshhorn Museum.
We have computers in the wall. You don't see them.
A lighting interface transports the biometrics to the 300-watt light bulbs hanging 3 meters from the ceiling. Stefan Akan is the museum's curator.
It's an incandescent light bulb. It vibrates or pulsates at the rate of your heart.
In another room, a finger sensor combines with a digital microscope and a heart rate monitor. A projector displays the fingerprint onto an LCD screen, covering an entire gallery wall. Near the computer interface is an EKG image that shows the pulse rate. A third room translates heartbeats into ripples in an illuminated pool of water until the ripples slow and calmly stop, like a life. We brought someone to see Pulse who's passionate about art and the heart.
Nice, steady, normal heartbeat.
Cardiologist Susan Bennett says the exhibit offers someone like her more than art.
If there was a person who had atrial fibrillation and you brought them up and you asked me to take a look at this art exhibit, I would be able to tell they were in atrial fibrillation.
Back in the first room, the pulsing is constant. As a new heartbeat enters the grid, it pushes the others to the next light bulb.
After the 211th heartbeat, yours disappears. The artist says that's to remind us of what a short time we have on this planet. Carolyn Persutti, VOA News, Washington.
What a creative way to create art. Carolyn, thank you so much. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. I want to thank our studio team, Director Patrice Martin and Engineer Audrius Regis. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for listening.